Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. With 1 week left before the transfer deadline slams shut on Tuesday night here in the UK, we thought we would have a look at the big deals in the last week of the window, the ones yet to be completed, the ones still in the pipeline, the ones that may yet change everything for their respective clubs. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water, it's our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously an episode where teams are already looking to save their season, isn't it, really? I mean, you've got Man United, Tottenham, Aston Villa, all suffering embarrassing opening day results. And then you've got Liverpool, Man City, who didn't lose, but equally they could do with a bit more optimism. And so those five clubs are like among the teams we're going to be talking about today on this episode, as we count down towards another transfer deadline. It's already been, look, it's been a good window. The amount of money being signed on mid-tier players is probably needs an investigation of some sort. This needs to stop. We can't just keep going up and up and up. There needs to be a ceiling put on this, but that's a story for another day. Today we'll just get excited about our team's seasons being potentially rescued in these final days.
Yeah, or put to rights, you know, some of the issues, some of the gaping holes that we've seen in these teams. There is maybe some overreactions, according to a variety of different fan bases. We looked back at the first weekend of the Premier League season over on our Patreon. We'd love you to come and join us over there. We did kind of a full breakdown of all the questions we were sent ahead or after the weekend and after those opening games for everybody. But this is a little bit more of a kind of look forward to see what deals we might be keeping an eye on over the course of the next week, the big ones in that regard. DJ, where do you want to kick off today?
Well, look, Man United have just signed Carlos Baleba, so it seemed a good way to start the episode. A player that has wanted this transfer for the past year. Man United ending up paying 65 million initially, approaching 70 million eventually. That's 30 million pounds less than they were quoted a year ago. Like, I know Baleba didn't have a great season for Brighton, but largely that's because of the fact that he kind of lost his head, I guess, and in the madness of it all. And he said today, I'm joining the club of my dreams. So if you think for the last year, he had that chance and he thought it had gone. United did go for him last summer. They did go for him in January. They did go for him at the start of this summer. It was 100. It was 100. It was 100. They've got him for 70 million pounds. When you throw that in with the amounts that they've paid for Tielemans and Santos, United feel that they've actually got really good value here in the market. And that is something which they've been very, very keen to get. If you consider that, you know, say, for example, they wanted Elliot Anderson, he ends up going for 116 million pounds. Like, they haven't got involved in those sorts of figures. They have never paid 100 million pounds for a footballer. And so they feel like this is a good deal. And they feel it's really important that they get players who want to play for this club. We saw at the weekend, Man United aren't finished. They've got flaws in this squad. Santos and Tielemans extremely underwhelming as they lost to Hull City. Well, now they've got Baleba. He's not going to be fit straight away. He needs time to get up and running for this season. But when he does come into this team, he's going to make a big impact.
I think one of the things that was quite clearly missing at the weekend was that little bit of bite, right? That little bit of snap in the midfield. And we saw that with the way that Hull kind of came with this team. Now, I'm expecting to see more from Andre Santos. I'm expecting to see a huge improvement from Yuri Tielemans on what we saw in that game. But what Baleba does give Manchester United is a little bit more of a destructive presence, shall we say, in the midfield. Someone who's going to win the ball back, someone who's going to create turnovers, someone who's going to, you know, make sure that when the ball is there in the middle of the pitch, it's going up to the players who can, you know, make sure that things happen in transition. And for me, that's the thing that at the weekend felt like it was missing. You know, you looked at what Hull did really, really nicely. And yes, part of it was strikers dropping in, but it was the fact that they didn't let United have a moment's peace with the ball in midfield. And when the ball was won back or won and was in those areas, it felt like Tielemans and Santos could only really kind of pass the ball between each other because there was no kind of passing lanes open to them to get the ball into that final third. I think that in Baleba, Manchester United suddenly have a player who, you know, one, is very, very good out of possession. Two, is a lovely kind of turn and drive with the ball and can open games up in that regard. But also is someone who won't give opponents the moments that they need in order to go back the other way and hurt United in the way that Hull did at the weekend.
Yeah, exactly that. And obviously, like, they are just looking to fix areas of their squad piece by piece. And the midfield was the area that they set about for an entire overhaul. Look, most people were saying at the start of this summer that United would sign two centre midfielders. And I said from day one of, even before the window opened, no, they'll sign three. Like, they need three. And that's been the case for a while now. Like, if you go back to last year, like, the fact they didn't sign Baleba, they didn't sign anyone else. But there was a gap in the squad. Obviously, Ugarte was supposed to leave this summer, but his injury means that he hasn't. But there's no future for Ugarte at Man United. They just need to get into a place where he can probably be moved on again. They've got the three central midfielders that they were aiming for. They're not the three that I think they ideally wanted. I think that there's Tchouaméni, there's Anderson, there's perhaps Camavinga, perhaps Tonali, perhaps three others, to be honest, that they might have got ahead of these three. But the price points they've got them at the squad level, depth level, you know, conversations that we always have, like, that's all improved. Now it all needs to come together. And look, Carrick was a brilliant midfielder. Like, this is literally his job. He's the full-time coach now of Man United. If there's one area of the pitch he should be able to fix, it's the centre of the midfield. So I do expect that to be sorted out. And now we move on to sorting out that left-back position. United know they can't survive a season with just Luke Shaw. He's going to miss games. They knew that they couldn't trust Harry Amass. They don't trust Patrick Dorgu to be a left back. They don't really want Mazraoui playing there. They don't know what to do there. So they've been searching the market. They want Lewis Hall. That's what they want. They can't get it. So what do? They're waiting for an option to open up, an opportunity in the market. And, you know, Alejandro Balde from Barcelona is an option for them. But they've got to be careful because, ideally, they see Lewis Hall as the long-term solution for them at left back. There was Nathaniel Brown, who they've really, really liked, went to Bayern Munich, going to be great for them. And then beneath that was Lewis Hall, who, I know he gave away a penalty for Newcastle at the weekend, but he was also definitely the best fullback on that pitch and one of the best players on that pitch. So again, do they go and put money into someone that isn't the guy they want, or do they wait like they've waited for Baleba right now? I'm not sure. I think they probably have to be some middle ground. Like, if they could get Balde on loan, or if they get Balde at a cut price, then maybe something like that is the solution.
I think it's interesting. We got asked about this by one of our patrons, Andy, on our Monday episode, and kind of looking back at it and thinking, you know, who are the solutions? He said, is David Raum the answer? Is Alejandro Balde the answer? I'm a huge Balde fan, but equally, he's really struggled to stay fit in recent seasons. And Barcelona, I think, have missed him when he's not been there. But they have got to a point where they seem to be turning to others in order to effectively be like, well, we can't trust you over the course of a season. And therefore, for United to kind of come in there and look at it and go, okay, is he the answer if Luke Shaw was to pick up an injury, you know, as he has done in previous seasons? I know that last year, Luke Shaw played 38 games in the Premier League and everyone was very impressed by it. But it's not something that we've seen from him throughout his career. The worry I would have is Balde good enough? I think on his day, absolutely sensational footballer and a real threat from that left-back position as well. But also, you have to develop those kind of relationships and also develop someone who's going to be there, fit and ready if your first choice left-back drops out. And that feels like a very difficult market to corner if they don't want someone who's going to be a bit more of a project.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of disappointing, to be honest, that they haven't been able to, in Luke Shaw's time at the club, bring someone in. as a natural replacement, whether it be through the system or whether it be somebody that they bought before now to slot in there. They've had attempts, I guess, at doing that, but it really just hasn't worked out. And I'd say a little bit concerning that they're scrambling in the final week to sign a position that they've wanted and known they needed all summer long.
Yeah, we will see. It's a funny one, because if they are absolutely dead set on getting Lewis Hall, if not this summer, then next summer perhaps, then they've got to try and fill it for a year. But it doesn't feel like short-term solutions are going to please the United fan base. And then I think that's a really interesting kind of place where they are. Let's go over to Liverpool, shall we? Because there is a lot of talk about how Liverpool are going to fill a variety of different roles on the pitch.
Yeah, look. When Salah left the club, it became clear immediately that they were going to look for someone elite to come into the squad. They obviously had good options. They have good options, but they don't feel they have anyone in the same class as Salah to regularly...
I mean, that's a difficult thing to ask, right?
It is, but, you know, I mean, as a like for like, yeah, that is, but they... obviously spent all that money on Wirtz and Isak, and you kind of do have to just evolve a team sometimes in different ways. And when you consider the options that Liverpool have got, I personally do think there should be more priority in other areas than just going and signing another winger, but they seem to think it is essential. And I mean, Liverpool and PSG, I mean, they've talked more this summer than me and you have, Jack. I mean, it's been unbelievable. Like, how many conversations do you need?
I mean, who knows? I mean, it's part of this. And one of the things that has been kind of floated, I suppose, with the takeover and the consortium and all those things that are sort of going on behind the scenes at Liverpool. Yes, it's not a full takeover, but there's a lot of speculation that that might be kind of soft launching into the consortium taking over from FSG after a year or two. Is this part of the issue, that there is a feeling that what the director of football is on his way out? There is this conclusion that maybe this is the end of FSG's time. Is that dragging into this?
I mean, I honestly think it's more to be a case that PSG have just been extremely stubborn over the fee, and that Liverpool are trying to restrict the limits at which they're willing to spend on this deal. But the problem they've had all along is PSG don't need the money. Like, they don't need to sell him at £100 million. Like, if they say we want 130, then Liverpool are finding it difficult to get below that amount. Talks are still going on. Like, this can still happen. This may well still happen. But at the same time, we're obviously still hearing about Mbaye being a target. We're obviously hearing new talk about Yankuba Minteh at Brighton emerging as an option. Minteh's not even going to be fit for at least two more months. But Liverpool want him to come into the squad. I mean, that's one of the more bizarre things to me. To be genuinely feeling that Minteh is essential at this point, rather than
I like Minteh, but with him being injured for a couple of months, is that a smokescreen?
I just don't see the need for it right now. Like, there's no competition for the player. He can't play right now. And you've got other issues in this squad which are glaringly obvious, you know. Potentially still a problem at right back, potentially still a problem at centre back. I know they've just signed someone, but like, I still feel that that's going to be something that crops up across the season. Obviously, the big conversation that is constantly ongoing is, why have Liverpool not signed a defensive midfielder? So, and then you still got them looking to move Cody Gakpo on potentially if they get in Barkley on another. And Gakpo's been one of their best players in their opening game of the season. So, it's a confusing one at Liverpool, but they do genuinely seem to harbour this feeling that without Salah, the level has dropped significantly, and they're very worried about that. Let's see how far... let's see if they cave, basically, here. Because they've spent so long, as I say, they have spent the entire summer talking about this deal. What a waste of time if they just walk away from it in the final few days.
Just on that, and on Barkley in particular, but we'll talk about kind of Liverpool and how they're evolving in just a second. But, you know, there's obviously talk about the idea that Gabriel Martinelli might leave Arsenal. We'll talk about that a little bit later, kind of in its own right. But when you think about the idea that Arsenal might need to bulk up their left side, we've talked all summer about the idea that Arsenal have money to spend if they want to spend it. is there a chance that if Liverpool are balking at that fee and PSG are going, well, we don't need to sell any lower than that, that they end up getting gazumped for Bradley Barcola?
I mean, potentially. I mean, we've got to remember, I know I said 130 mil a minute ago, but I mean, that's even wishful thinking. PSG's actual price coming into this market is £145 million. I mean, that's outrageous. Do you genuinely think that Barcola is worth £145 million?
Back-to-back Champions League winner. It depends who it is. Like, and it depends who it's for. Is he worth that to X club? I mean, I think that what's quite funny now is he's probably not worth that to PSG, considering the amount that they've spent over the course of the summer, the fact that Mika Gotch has come in, the fact that Akili Uche's come in, the fact that Ferran Torres has come in. It's a very fluid front line that we know kind of moves around. Is Barcola now worth that to PSG with the array of attacking talent that they have in the tank? Maybe not, but is he worth that to Liverpool if they feel like he is the key piece to absolutely unlocking this side? I can see why PSG are holding their value. They're going, well, this is a back-to-back Champions League winner who's just got to a World Cup semi-final and been part of a very, very talented France squad where he's rotated in and out of the team. This is someone who might well be a superstar for a decade. We're sticking with our valuation.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's primarily played on the left wing, right, as well. Like, what about the right wing? Like, where are Liverpool going to play him?
I don't know.
That's what's intriguing to me, because we see the weekend and they start, Rio plays there just to start off with, and then they bring in Victor Munoz and you have Cody Gakpo starting on the left. And I'm just like, I don't 100% understand what the plan is for how that front line shapes up as a starting 11.
No, and I don't think anyone does, right? Like, we don't know exactly what that is. But I think what Liverpool are trying to do is get in wingers who want to go in behind order to open that space up for Florian Wirtz. One of the things I think is interesting about Liverpool's evolution is, okay, there's a lot of talk about Salah and replacing his goals and his output on that right-hand side. I don't think you're going to be able to do that in this window. I don't think that right winger is on the market. And if you cannot get a like-for-like replacement without all going all Moneyball and how do we replace him in the aggregate, that what you do is you give the creative keys to someone like a Florian Wirtz. And I was talking to a couple of Liverpool fans about this last week, and in particular, Keith Costigan, who I do a radio show with, and he was talking about the idea that it's very hard to revolutionize a club when the old guard is still there. It's very hard to change the way that a club plays if for 4 or 5 years, they've looked for Mohamed Salah every single time on that right-hand side to be the saviour. And suddenly, while he's still on the pitch, you're saying, no, no, give the ball to this lad in the centre now. We're attacking in a new way. And I think that's what's, you know, we saw this a little bit with the way when Coutinho left, the way that Liverpool evolved off the back of that, right? Where they didn't effectively play with a number 10 anymore. And the change in the dynamic of the team obviously worked in their favour in the years that followed that whole situation. So I think what this is a complete shift away from maybe the way that they have played, the fact that they've looked to that right-hand side so much and actually getting players in behind, being a little bit more vertical. We know that, you know, Iraola likes to coach a system that plays in transition, that gets people into dangerous areas and opens up spaces. That is why I think Barcola is so important as a target to Liverpool, because he is a player unlike a Cody Gakpo, who I understand your point with in terms of leaving the club, but actually when you're kind of coming to the point of, yes, he was good at the weekend, but he sort of occupies the same spaces that Florian Wirtz does. If they are revolutionizing and they are going, right, we have faith that Wirtz is going to be the guy. He's going to be the man that we're giving effectively this lightning rod to in the center of the park and saying, here you go, control this team. It's your team now. You need runners rather than players who are going to kind of occupy that space. And that feels like a massive shift away from what they've done in recent years, where Cody Gakpo felt more like a kind of, nowhere near as good, but like a mirror image in some ways of Salah on the other side, in that he was going to come inside and get those shots off. They're clearly trying to move away from that, I think.
Yeah, probably. And look, this is supposed to be more fun now. This is supposed to be moving into a new era. They're getting Liverpool fans off their seats. And I wasn't as downbeat on Liverpool from the first weekend as I know a lot of their fans were, but I guess I don't have to be. Gakpo, meanwhile, could be going to Manchester City or Tottenham if these deals open up. So that'll be one that we have to keep an eye on. Gakpo doesn't just want to be a squad filler. He wants to be a main player in a top team. So Man City going to certainly hold appeal, because Tottenham already was appealing to him. Just to move it on quickly to Man City, the Enzo Fernandez deal, which has been talked about for weeks, I've reported on for months, finally seems like close to actually getting somewhere. City have never actually made an approach for Enzo Fernandez. It's just been a terribly kept secret since Maresca came into the job. Chelsea set their own transfer deadline 2 weeks ago, which isn't how football works.
I was going to say, this is so funny. Unless you're Borussia Dortmund and this is Jadon Sancho, I've never ever seen someone successfully pull this off.
It's just like, yep, Friday's the cutoff, 5 p.m. Friday. It's like, nah, there's another 2 weeks after that. Like, two and a half weeks. Like, we don't have to do that. We can do whatever
also,
we want.
Also, the Rodri deal wasn't done at that point. They were like, we don't know what's going on with Rodri yet. We're obviously not going to kind of make a bid here if we don't necessarily know if Rodri's leaving.
And they've kind of twisted that into, well, what we mean is that the terms that were on, would have been available to you then aren't available now. The price is going up. And so what was a £120 million transfer in Chelsea's eyes is moving up towards £130, £140 million. But Man City are realistic about the situation. They know that Enzo Fernandez is keen to join them. They know that given the history of Enzo Fernandez from last season when he was fluttering eyelids towards Real Madrid and the fallout that they've had since. I mean, Chelsea fans didn't seem to be jeering him on Monday night quite in the same vein that Fulham fans were, but yeah, it is what it is.
When he starts getting stick from the opposition, they almost like banded back together. It's like, oh, when we're giving him stick, that's fine. But as soon as he was booed on, yeah.
He's playing for you, but you know, a lot of Chelsea fans don't like him. And once he does leave them, they'll love to give him some stick, I think. I do think it will happen. I do think Enzo will be a Man City player by the end of the transfer window. Enzo Maresca signaled this before he even took the job. And obviously he's looking for comfort in terms of getting players into this team that he knows and understands. And that's why he's also knocked on the door to potentially sign Pedro Neto, potentially sign Malagusto. He just wants players now that he knows, because otherwise Man City and their season could spiral. So we'll see if he manages to get any more than Enzo, but I do think he'll get Enzo. And just to wrap up this section, really, like, that's going to obviously have a knock-on effect at Chelsea, because they'll need something. Now, we've talked about before on here, is that Alex Scott, Adam Wharton, Lamine Kamara, like, there's two different directions they can go in here. Do they go tried and tested Prem and go and spend another 100 mil? Or do they look for someone who's a bit more bargain bucket, but might be more astute, might be smarter, might fit with the old framework that they were trying to work within before they started going, okay, let's just spend the money and get experienced players in again? They're stuck a little bit. I think personally, from what I'm hearing, it's probably Alex Scott that they go for, because they think Alex Scott wants to go more than Adam Wharton does. And at the right price, Bournemouth probably do sell.
Just on that, I mean, look, I think Bournemouth would sell at the right price because that's kind of the model that they operate within, right? But there is also a sense that, you know, you don't lose anyone else if you're Marco Rosa, because you've already lost quite a lot of key players over the course of this summer. With Palace, it feels like this kind of this weird exodus happening where, you know, it was a happy camp and everyone seemed to be kind of on board and moving in the right direction. And then suddenly Mateta's appealing to FIFA that his contract isn't right. And there's whispers of Dani Muñoz being linked with teams around the country you wouldn't kind of expect Dani Muñoz to be going to. It all feels like it's falling apart a little bit at Palace. And I wonder if Adam Wharton's looking around him and going, hang on, these aren't the lads that I thought I was with this season. And things are looking slightly different to what they did a couple of days ago.
I mean, he does seem to have a sense of loyalty, which is rare these days.
No, I would love him to stay for what it's worth, but like,
I don't, I mean, it's a really tough one for him, because I don't necessarily think he should stay, to be honest. Given the direction of the club, you know, I watched every game from this opening weekend and Palace were alarming. Like, they were certainly ranking my worst three teams of this weekend. And there are deep issues there, some of which we're going to address in a minute in the second part. But Wharton has been a part of their success, has been lifted European silverware, wants to stay part of it, has kind of signaled he will stay part of it. Palace also seem to have a real stubbornness about selling him too, which I don't think is going to be as easy to change as Bournemouth's might be. So we'll see. But once that Enzo deal begins to be unlocked, I think we'll hear exactly where Chelsea are angling.
Okay. All right. Well, we will see what happens with that one, but we could start a final week domino effect, which could really spiral out of control, shall we say. Right. On that note, it's probably time for us to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk a little bit about Aston Villa as well. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's Jack Collins and Dean Jones alongside you, looking ahead to this final week of the transfer window. And Dean, you said Palace were amongst the teams you might have ranked at the bottom or towards the bottom of the teams that played in the Premier League at the weekend. You'd imagine that Aston Villa would be right there as well. An absolutely catastrophic 30-minute period where they conceded four times and had a debutant sent off in João Gomes. And it looks like Unai Emery is dealing with all sorts of things. Now, I don't think there's any reason for Villa fans to massively panic. They started last season quite badly and it ended in obviously glory with Europa League and the fact that they're back in Champions League football and had a very, very good campaign. But also, the spine of this team feels like it's either been ripped out or is being ripped out. It looks like Emi Martinez has been kind of usurped or gazumped as number one by the introduction of Zion Suzuki. Ezri Konsa has gone to Arsenal. Yuri Tielemans has gone to Manchester United. Morgan Rodgers has gone to Chelsea. And it looks like Ollie Watkins is apparently trying to force a move to Saudi Arabia. Unai Emery's comments after the game I thought were very, very telling. And suddenly Villa have loads and loads of work to do in the final week of the transfer window.
They do, yeah. And I mean, it's no surprise that Palace and Villa struggled in game week one, given what they've been through over the, well, since the end of last season, really. But Villa, intent on making sure that they redress the balance. I mean, difficult for them, you know, no Ollie Watkins, you know, knocks to Tammy Abraham, Brian Maggio. And so they're trying to now fix that. Nicholas Jackson, obviously somebody that Unai Emery knows very well from their time at Villarreal. £65 million incoming deal from Chelsea, looking very plausible. But at the same time as that, Villa are also exploring, potentially trying to get Mateta out of Crystal Palace. Mateta clearly doesn't want to be at Crystal Palace anymore. Hasn't for a while, to be honest. If you think back to when Man United were showing interest in Mateta, that feeling hasn't changed.
And then Mateta's Milan shot. Debacle.
Yeah, exactly. And they've also, like, you know, Rafael Leao's been touted around half the world over the past month. And Villa, one of the few clubs to actually have a little nibble on that, just to be like, you know what? Maybe. Like, we've obviously seen Villa over the past couple of years emerge as a club that like to give people another opportunity. Rashford, Garnacho. Maybe Leao comes into that equation. But primarily at the moment, it's been Jackson and Mateta on their radar. And I think that it just goes to show that, like, they know the situation that they're in. They tried to make changes. You know, they signed Suzuki, they signed João Gomes, they signed Mazembe. You know, they're trying to kind of get this squad back together. But does anyone really believe in it? Does anyone truly believe that Villa can kick on again from last season? You have to reserve judgment on them. I've seen some really hot takes / stupid takes that Villa are going to fight against relegation, that Emery's not going to last 2 months in the job, blah, blah, blah. But you'll know that Villa have hot and cold spells in a season. Like, this is nothing new. Go back to last season and look how they fared over the first six games of the season. They can fix this. And they will seek to fix this. It's just that they've also got to balance out the fact that they've got a busy schedule.
I think what was interesting is that, like, up to this point, up to the week just gone by, it felt like Villa had actually replaced the missing players quite well. Like, I thought that João Gomes was a good Tielemans replacement, and obviously they've got Boubacar Kamara coming back, and then Anana got out injured, and so there's a lot of kind of shuffling around in the middle of the park. But when you look at the players that came in, Manzambi as a Rodgers replacement felt like a pretty reasonable place to go for them at that point. He's a slightly different player in terms of his style, but you know the way he's going to play and the way he's going to be deployed by Emery, I imagine is as a creative attacking force in the way that Morgan Rodgers was. Now we're seeing, it looks like Joel Ordonez is going to be the replacement for Ezri Konsa, which feels like a smart bit of business. He's someone that Premier League clubs have been sniffing around for a little while. We saw links to Liverpool over the last 2 years or so. That feels like a kind of gamble worth taking. And then if you go and get a Nicholas Jackson as an Ollie Watkins replacement, I think that all of those, you know, like for like replacements feel like sensible maneuvers. It's just about settling them all in. But do Villa need to improve? And I think the question is, have they improved with the players that have come in to replace the ones that have gone? My hunch is probably not. And I think that maybe they've got a little bit worse with an eye to getting better again in the future. You've got to ride these waves a little bit if you're a club where Villa are in terms of PSR. But it does feel interesting that everything has sort of happened at once. And, you know, we talked about those spirals and domino effects happening. I wonder if there's a little bit of that with Konsa and with Watkins now, where they're looking around and going, hang on, this isn't the same team that I've been through everything with. And maybe it's time for a change. Maybe it's time for a renewal.
Yeah, absolutely that. Look, at the same time as this, both these clubs, Aston Villa and Crystal Palace, have been linked with Jonathan David. I'm not sure about his desire to actually move to the Premier League at this point. And there are links with Atleti at the moment that have been growing across the day. So it could be that he does opt for something different anyway. But obviously what is interesting about Jonathan David is that he doesn't fit in with Juventus' plans for the season. He's known that for a while. Once he's out the door, it's pretty likely that Juve tried to sign Josh Zirkzee from Man United, which has been mooted for like, I don't know, a year, 18 months. Like that's been written so many times. Zirkzee, still somebody that's fine to have in the Man United squad, but isn't like changing what is possible in their season particularly. So I would kind of expect that to have an impact as well. Just to kind of round off here, something that is interesting is movement at Newcastle United, who, you know, like Villa, like Palace, have been in a state of flux across the summer, and they've just been fighting off offers left, right, and centre, and somewhat unsuccessfully as well. They've really had struggles. They've managed to keep hold of a couple, and they've got a new boss who at least is enthusiastic about what is still possible. So Newcastle's opening day performance against Liverpool definitely gives the club hope of what else they could do this season without all those big names that have left. And Nico Gonzalez from Manchester City, somebody that they're now looking to get through the door, pretty sharpish. They've been pushing towards this one, and they are hopeful that it can be done. The other two areas that Newcastle have been considering is, do we need another centre-back, and do we need another forward? Now, the centre-back, I'm told, as of last night anyway, probably won't happen. They probably won't go for someone significant anyway in that area. But as an attacking unit, I still think we'll see an addition. Now, Avissa kind of seemed reborn at the weekend. I wasn't expecting a performance of that level from him, partly because I haven't seen it for so long, but partly because I just...
Outside of the World Cup, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in club football, like I just haven't seen that Avissa. He joined the pieces together beautifully. He made great runs. He was explosive when he needed to be. He dropped deep when he needed to. He opened the team up in ways that Newcastle really needed, and they obviously showed themselves to be very good in transition. But the options outside of him, William Asula, Nick Voltimada, I don't know if they're completely happy with that. Now, on the flanks, they've shown that they've got pace and they've got breakaway power, but they are looking into this deal for, I don't know if I'll pronounce his name here right, Jack, you'll know better than me, Matias Fernandez Pardo from Lille.
Speed merchant.
This is one that is really, really coming onto the radar. 40 million, a guy that they see as being capable of playing across the front three. Mm-hmm. Watch out for it. Watch out for this deal. Like, there's something in this. It's been quite quick in the way that it's coming together. And I'm not sure there's much want for it to happen from the Lille end of things. But yeah, there is something in this. So that tells me that even if it's not him, Newcastle was still going to look to be active in that front line.
I really like this as a potential move for Newcastle United because he is such an explosive runner. He has featured, you know, as part of a front two, as a lone striker at times from wide areas and a little bit deeper in the 10, giving us someone like a Matthias Yeisler who wants to play such vertical football. And we saw that at the weekend, right, with the way that Newcastle tried to play on the break in particular. Giving him a player of this kind of explosivity would be a real joy to behold, I think, in many ways. So at the very least, it suggests that the dots are being joined up at Newcastle. For a long time, it felt like the entire structures above Eddie Howe, and we know that they had their problems with directors of football, et cetera, at Newcastle. It felt like everything was a bit chaotic and certain players came in. You were like, how do they fit with what Eddie Howe is trying to do? I think the Voldemar is signing at the kind of back end of last summer to replace Alexander Isak was an example of this. Voldemar is a really interesting footballer and I think a phenomenal player in the right system, but you effectively have to build an entire team around him in order for it to work because he's so unique in his skill set. And you're kind of looking at this and thinking, okay, now it suggests that Newcastle are, you know, in tune with what their manager wants, in tune with the style of football they want to play. I think Fernando Espada would be a very, very interesting addition and someone who would suit the Premier League. So I like that quite a lot. And it does suggest that Newcastle, at the very least, all on the same page for the first time in a little while. Just to circle back around and ask you one question before we take a break. One of the links I thought was really interesting, it happened, you know, midway through towards the end of last week, was Flo Balogun to Aston Villa was the link kind of popped out and around. Now, there have also been links to Tottenham. There have been links to Barcelona. I'm not sure that any of those particularly work, although I quite liked Villa as a potential destination for Balogun, who feels like he needs to make a move this summer. He was left out of Monaco's squad in their first game in Ligue 1 at the weekend. There are some question marks about how he fits within this new setup. I'm quite intrigued on what Flo Balogun's future looks like.
Yeah, it's definitely an intriguing one for this week, Balogun, because as you say, I don't think he's even training with Monaco at the moment. I don't, let alone be involved in the actual team. It feels like they're kind of freezing him out of the side while they address this situation heading towards the deadline, which is not ideal for anyone, to be honest. And for Balogun, I hope it works out the way that he's planning. I think that he sensed an opportunity to make a move. I think he showed, obviously, at the World Cup early on that he could lead a line well. He could score on the biggest stage, obviously.
His stock's quite high right now, I think.
I think his stock is high. I mean, obviously, the red card ended up like kind of overshadowing anything else he did at the World Cup. But like, he was good and he is good.
But there's not much you can do about that situation either. That just happens to him.
Yeah, I'm just not sure like where this actually ends up going because, you know, Tottenham are signing Marmoush, so not really. I don't think he's going to Tottenham. I haven't heard that like in this last week.
Yeah, a weird one as well, being ex-Arsenal, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that one's like Villa, same like we just talked about, their targets doesn't feel like it's right there for them. So it's a case of like really looking at it and thinking like, where would he go? Like, I don't know, like Man City haven't got a backup for Haaland. I can't see them signing him. I can't see Everton signing him and they're looking for a striker. You go through the options and I'm thinking like, is he even going to end up in the Premier League? Is he going to go somewhere else? And maybe that's how this actually ends up going because I genuinely am not hearing a lot about Balogun at the moment, but he is a player that has to leave. Look, maybe Crystal Palace becomes an option. Like Palace actually feels like a very good level for him and actually would be a good fit.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I also wonder if there is something in the idea that if Jonathan David does leave Juventus, if they would maybe be interested in that market. And so, you know, obviously would be amongst teammates in some regards. I think that there would be a potential fit there. But yeah, it just feels like an odd situation. I'm sure that there would be a situation where if he wasn't sold, he could be brought back in from the cold at Monaco because clearly he's a player that they will want to have value, even if that comes in January. But yeah, it just feels like an odd situation. And it feels like maybe if this had been made available earlier in the window, teams who did make those signings in those positions might have looked at Flo Balogun as an alternate and gone, yeah, you know what? That's maybe more of a slightly proven property that we might take a gamble on. So we'll see. But I just thought it was an interesting one to bring up.
Yeah, it is. Look, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but one of the clubs that keeps getting mentioned for him is Barcelona, because people are like, why don't they just try and sign him? We'll talk about that in the next section, because we're going to discuss the options that they've been weighing up so far.
Okay, then we will take a break. We'll be back with more chat around some moves that look like they're on the verge of happening, as well as that Barcelona number 9 chat. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to the third and final part of this Ranks FC episode, where we're looking ahead to the final week of the transfer window. Dino, a couple of deals that are sort of on the verge of being done that feel very, very interesting. I don't know where you wanted to start here.
Yeah, well, look, one of my favourite teams actually from the weekend were Ipswich, who I really enjoyed their game. It's funny because I made fun of you the other day on Patreon. You said you were looking forward to watching Ipswich v Sunderland. I said you must be the only neutral in the world that I've ever heard saying that right now. I ended up watching the entire 90 minutes as a replay and really enjoyed it. It was a good game.
I also said I thought Ipswich would be very good this season. I think that they have the best chance for the three promoted sides as it stands. And on the way basis of what I watched at the weekend, I don't think I'm miles off with that either.
Yeah, look, I don't know a lot about the player we're about to talk about, but they are linked with Ezequiel Palacios from Bayer Leverkusen. It seems like this deal is moving pretty fast now and it's going to be concluded. So what would you say that tells us about the direction of the team and the side?
Well, there's a couple of things that are interesting here, I think, because the way that Ipswich have gone about their business, there's been a lot of kind of comparisons to Sunderland last year. And I think the one that's maybe the most important is that they've not been overly loyal to a load of the players that were in the championship and helped get them promoted. They've gone, right, we might need to upgrade in almost every position if we're going to have a chance of actually staying in the Premier League. And they've taken a little bit from Sunderland, they've taken a little bit from Leeds, in that they've clearly prioritised physicality in the middle of the park. Now, they brought in Sasha Lukic from Fulham, who's got that experience in the Premier League. He's a bit of a kind of cruncher. We know about his yellow card record. They brought in Florentino Luis, who didn't do brilliantly at Burnley, but I think in a more settled midfield is a very, very good player and was excellent at Benfica for many years. And now it looks like they're bringing on Palacios, who, again, is someone that can come in there, give them some defensive stability, good pass with the ball as well as Ezequiel Palacios. But when you're kind of looking at it, I think it's a shift. They played a 4-2-3-1 at the weekend and it worked quite nicely. Julio Enciso basically allowed to run the ship in the middle, but he drifts out wide anyway. And I think the question mark is, if they do bring in that extra body, maybe it's for away games and maybe games that they think are a little bit more winnable, they go to a 4-2-3-1. Gary O'Neill is an adaptable coach in that regard. But a 4-3-3 with Lukic, a Florentino Luis, and then Ezequiel Palacios in the middle, good luck running through that. The last time Ipswich were in the Premier League, I thought that they were way too easy to get through in the middle of the park. They were turned over there. They were run through. They were effectively blitzed in a way that, you know, we see quite often from promoted sides who don't stock up that area of the pitch. What Leeds did well was they basically went, right, we're going to be absolutely impossible to run through. You can beat us with quality. You can beat us with talent, but you are absolutely not going to out-physical us in the middle. I think Ipswich are going for something quite similar. And for me, this is a really good transfer. I think they've done good business in the middle of the park. This would be the cherry on the cake for me.
Yeah, interesting. And I'll flip that forward because it's there's a former Ipswich forward making a transfer today in Liam Delap, who obviously has been at Chelsea. That deal was ambitious, didn't quite work out for any party, but Chelsea are managing to sell him for £50 million to Nottingham Forest. It's a club record fee. He's just got to finalise this deal now, but, you know, Chelsea signed the player for £30 million and they're selling him for £50 million. That ain't bad. That ain't bad.
It's like 50% profit when you take into account the fact that obviously some of it be written off for the last year for a player who really struggled. And look, I think that Liam Delap will be fine. Like he didn't fit at Chelsea and it wasn't a good debut season, but the idea that they've made a profit on him is wild in so many ways.
Yeah. I mean, I would kind of take a step back from it to assess it and be like, do you know what? Like, take that year out of the equation. If Nottingham Forest had signed Liam Delap a year ago, you'd have been like, what a signing. What a signing. Go back and watch Liam Delap at Ipswich in that season. The power, the confidence to charge with the ball. He was like a He's like Haaland on his day in terms of the power in which he can storm through. If you look at like what Haaland did at the weekend, like that wasn't a great Man City performance, but if you watch Haaland like in the opening stages of Man City's game the other day, he had that like hunger and power about him where he was like looking to storm through the middle of the pitch. Delap used to do that all the time for Ipswich, and Forrest might be able to get him back to feeling confident again in that sense. This Forrest team is very ambitious. They've obviously gone and spent less money, £34 million on getting Ousmane Diomande through the door. So they pull off some good deals. They really do. And they're putting together a side that is going to make sure that they establish themselves properly as a Premier League outfit. And Chelsea just didn't need him anymore. They didn't see a fit for him anymore. They brought in Danny Welbeck. They got Emmanuel Emega coming into the side.
Is Omega going to stay now? Because it felt like he was going to go as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, now that Delap's gone, it makes me wonder if Omega does hang around. But, you know, Delap struggled with opportunity, with injury. You know, it was just a move that didn't work out. But I think he's still at a stage of his career. He's only 23. He can recover from this. He can use it for his benefit. And he's got a lot to motivate him, you know? Like, there was... As soon as England were knocked out of the World Cup, there was this immediate debate, like, well, who's the next England striker? Like, Harry Kane's getting towards, might have one more World Cup in him, but, like, we don't have a proper nine. Like, who's it going to be? And Liam Delap's in a situation whereby, like, if he takes the next couple of years by storm, it's him. Now, I can't see it at the moment, but you could have said the same thing about Harry Kane at similar stage of his career. You never would have thought that the last 10 years of Harry Kane's career would have gone anywhere close to how dominant he's been as a goal scoring force. Delap's got it in him. You know, you look at the way that he's been brought up, you look at the pedigree that he's got as a youngster. He's a great player. But has he found the right team? That's going to be the question.
Mate, Liam Delap wouldn't start for Ireland, never mind England. But, you know, also in the last 5 minutes, I can imagine the comments section already. In the last 5 minutes, you've compared him to Erling Haaland and Harry Kane. And based on what we saw at Chelsea last season, I think there's going to be some people looking at those comparisons and thinking, and I know what you mean, in terms of like the stylistic nature of his approach and the fact that he might be a late developer. Like, I take your point, but I do want to just caveat that for you.
But you don't need to, mate. He has played for England at every level, right? Every level since he was a kid. He's played for England every level. Came through youth academy, which saw him competing at Man City, like an extremely difficult time in their development side, which was one of the most competitive in the country at that point. His dad was a professional footballer, which meant he's had to deal with pressure since day one, but also it's in his blood to kind of keep going and keep improving. He's only 23. Like, Liam Delap's a really good player. It's just like, can you find a place for him to fully flourish? Because obviously at Man City, he ended up going on loan at various championship clubs, settled down at Ipswich, had an explosive season that kind of blew him up. Then Chelsea took a gamble on him, didn't work out. Now it has to work. 23 years old as a striker, 23 to 26, this is it. And I do have the, obviously, like, comparing him to Haaland and Kane is extreme, but like, there aren't many natural goal scorers of that type anymore. And Delap, I genuinely think, could be there if he fulfills his potential.
I think one of the things that's interesting is, well, two things actually. One, I think Ole Glasner will really like him, right? Because he likes that kind of frame of striker to work with. And secondly, you know, he goes into that Chelsea team and there's not really anyone to help mentor him along. I think in Chris Wood, he's got someone who's a very, very strong mentor for someone like Liam Delap, not just in terms of the way he plays, you know, and his experience, but Chris Wood was someone who was knocked back lots and lots. I remember him being in the Championship and people being like, why would you sign Chris Wood? He was a super late bloomer in terms of his Premier League career and what he achieved with Nottingham Forest. So having someone who's able to, you know, relate to some of the difficulties that you've gone through in the previous season, relate to some of the injury issues that you've had, and also say, look, it can happen. It doesn't have to happen in a linear fashion for everyone. It's something that you work on and kind of develop and it can come later. I think will be a really good thing for Liam Delap. I agree. I think he will be a success at Nottingham Forest. But right now, I think a success in his career would be to have a Chris Wood career path, not necessarily an Erling Haaland career path.
He's going to be better than Chris Wood, promise. Mark Casado also linked with Nottingham Forest right now. So Forest continuing to show ambition. Looking at the Barcelona midfielder right now, loads of clubs have looked at Casado.
I was going to say, Fulham are apparently still monitoring this one as well.
There's loads, yeah. Fulham, Villa, Brighton, Newcastle, Sunderland, loads of them have been looking at Casado. But Forest, particularly hot on it right now, so that's one to look out for. Yeah, as we get into these final days. Al Hilal mentioned earlier, Ollie Watkins really wants to join Al Hilal. Come to backtrack a little bit at Aston Villa at the moment. He's clearly tried to force a move. Still think he's got a chance, but obviously Martinelli finalizing a move to Al Hilal at the moment. So
that's a weird one for me. I've got to say, like, I kind of get the Ollie Watkins move. He probably is not necessarily going to make another European Championship or a World Cup with England. His international career is probably coming towards its twilight days, where he's always been a backup, and that's no shame considering it's Harry Kane in front of you. I think he's probably looking at that and saying, I'm not going to get a contract like this for the rest of my career. Martinelli's a weird one, because there were links to Galatasaray earlier in the window that he reportedly turned down, said, I don't really want to leave the top five in Europe. I want to, you know, continue to compete in the Champions League, etc. I want to look at one of those moves. And a week later, we're talking about him moving to Saudi Arabia, which at his point in his career, I find a little bit weirder.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. But yeah, from an Arsenal perspective, there's a good fee up for grabs here. I think £50 million for Martinelli is probably about right.
Yeah, that feels like in the right ballpark, although I'd imagine that Arsenal fans would be absolutely livid that Chelsea have just got 50 million for Liam Delap and they're getting 50 million for Gabriel Martinelli, who played a relatively key part in their win of the Premier League and their run to the Champions League final last year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Martinelli was on about 180 grand a week at Arsenal. Probably double that.
Yeah, it probably does.
So while it might not fit your ambitions, like, it's extremely... I mean, look,
good luck to him, get your bag and get out, but it just feels odd that he would turn down a move to Turkey because he felt the league was below him and then move to Saudi Arabia. Like, that feels odd to me.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure there's other reasons outside of football that he feels will benefit him more. Look, the last thing to really chat about is the saga involving Julian Alvarez to Barcelona from Atletico Madrid. He did come off the bench for Atleti at the weekend. He was whistled and jeered when his name was read out before kickoff. He was jeered when he came on as a substitute. He didn't look particularly happy at any point during the game. He walked off the pitch at the end while the rest of his team were clapping the fans.
He's a sweet boy. You can't boo him. He looks too nice to boo.
You know, he just wanted to join Barcelona. That's all there is to it. And Atleti,
I can understand why Atleti fans are angry about that, but still, like, surely you want to show him that you want to keep him at this point, no?
Yeah. And it'll be interesting, because if the Barcelona move can't happen, then does he want the Premier League? We spoke about this in a bit more depth on the Patreon today, but this is the big... I am told that he doesn't really have much hunger to return to English football at the moment. I think you said on the Patreon this morning, if he does not have a desire to play for Arsenal, then there's absolutely no need for them to be signing him. Like, there's, you don't, as Premier League champions, sign someone that doesn't particularly want to be there. Arsenal aren't in that boat. But Arsenal obviously do want somebody that can play across the front line. And he's one of the few players that they have felt they might be able to get. In the meantime, for Barcelona, if they don't get Alvarez and they don't go for Balogun, then what do they do? Do they just leave it? Do they look at Victor Osimhen? Do they...
Here we go again.
Here we go again. I mean, it started to rear its head at the end of last week again, the Osimhen talk that I've been hearing for a little bit. But I don't know. I'm not still convinced that one happens either. It was, you know, Barca got off to a resounding win at the start of the season, won 5-0. Anthony Gordon, brilliant debut in La Liga. We'll see. But the Alvarez stuff needs to be cleared up sharpish. And I think in the next 24 hours or so, we'll start to hear something on that front.
I just am a bit confused as to why Barcelona are letting Omar Marmoush go to Tottenham. It feels like such a nice fit with this Flick system. Someone who's capable of playing in numerous positions. Is a super fluid front line. I think that we're looking at this Barcelona team now and thinking that looks a little bit more like PSG than it's ever done before. We're talking about players who can kind of come in off the flanks. Adeyemi, Gordon, Rafinha's played as the number nine in the last couple of games. The idea that they could have added an Omar Marmoush to that rotation feels like a really sensible, eminent move from where I'm sitting. And I'm very, very surprised that they haven't at the very least looked at that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because they're similar. They're similar. And he would have been a really good fit. But it's not really been mentioned too much, has it? So, yeah, there we go. Marmoush, obviously, and Savinho have joined Tottenham. That kind of revives their front line. I don't think there were too many people that would have anticipated after all the transfer activity that Tottenham would have lined up for the first game with Tell, Richarlison and Mikey Moore as their front three. I mean, that's obviously not the that's not what's to come. They
least of all Roberto De Zerbi by the sounds of it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that should be changed pretty sharpish now.
Okay. All righty. Well, I think on that note, we'll probably call this a day. We've got through a lot of different topics there and obviously going to be a very, very busy week on the transfer front. We'll be looking back at it once the window slams shut. We'll be talking about some of our favourite transfers and some of the teams who've had some of the most interesting transfer windows. There are lots of very intriguing windows over the course of Europe. But all that's left for me to do, say a massive thank you to Mr. Dean Jones, our transfer guru.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. As we said at the start, if you want more in terms of previews, in terms of reviewing the games at the weekend, our discussions across European football, all of that can be found over on our Patreon. We'd love for you to join us for this new season. So much to talk about, so much to discuss. It's a whole load of fun over there. And you can ask the questions that shape the conversations that we have. But for now, thank you so much for listening today. We'll see you all very, very shortly. Take it easy, Rank Squad. Peace.